Keep talking, Clifton said. Give the boys the signal. My brothers, the time has come for action, I shouted. And now I saw the youth members and some older men move around to the back of the crowd and up to meet the advancing group. Then something sailed up out of the dark and landed hard against my forehead, and I felt the crowd surge in close, sending the ladder moving backwards, and I was like a man tottering above a crowd on stilts, then dropping backwards into the street and clear, hearing the ladder clatter down. They were milling in a panic now when I saw Clifton beside me. It's Ross the Exhorter, he yelled. Can you use your hands? I can use my fists, I was annoyed. Well, all right then, here's your chance. Come on. Let's see you, Duke. He moved forward and seemed to dive into the whirling crowd, and I beside him, seeing them scatter into doorways and pound off in the dark. There's Ross over there, Clifton cried. And I heard the sound of breaking glass, and the street went dark. Someone had knocked out the light, and through the dimness I saw Clifton heading to where a red neon sign glowed in a dark window as something went past my head. Then a man ran up with a length of pipe, and I saw Clifton close with him, ducking down and working in close and grabbing the man's wrist and twisting suddenly like a soldier executing an about-face, so that now he faced me, the back of the man's elbow rigid across his shoulder, and the man rising on tiptoe and screaming as Clifton straightened smoothly and levered down on the arm. I heard a dry, popping sound and saw the man sag, and the pipe rang upon the walk. Then someone caught me hard in the stomach, and suddenly I knew that I was fighting too. I went to my knees and rolled and pulled erect, facing him. Get up, Uncle Tom, he said, and I clipped him. He had his hands and I had mine, and the match was even, but he was not so lucky. He wasn't down and he wasn't out, but I caught him two good ones and he decided to fight elsewhere. When he turned, I tripped him and moved away. The fight was moving back into the dark where the streetlights had been knocked out clear to the corner, and it was quiet except for the grunting and straining and the sound of footfalls and of blows. It was confusing in the dark, and I couldn't tell ours from theirs and moved cautiously, trying to see. Someone up the street in the dark yelled, "Break it up! Break it up!" And I thought, cops, and looked around for Clifton. The neon sign glowed mysteriously, and there was a lot of running and cursing. And now I saw him working skillfully in a store lobby before a red checks cashed here sign, and I hurried over, hearing objects sailing past my head and the crash of glass. Clifton's arms were moving in short, accurate jabs against the head and stomach of Ross, the Exhorter, punching him swiftly and scientifically, careful not to knock him into the window or strike the glass with his fists, working Ross between rights and lefts, jabbed so fast that he rocked like a drunken bull from side to side. And as I came up, Ross tried to bull his way out, and I saw Clifton drive him back and down into a squat, his hands upon the dark floor of the lobby, his heels back against the door like a runner against starting blocks. And now, shooting forward, he caught Clifton coming in, butting him, and I heard the burst of breath, and Clifton was on his back, and something flashed in Ross's hand, and he came forward. A short, heavy figure as wide as the lobby, now with the knife, moving deliberately. I spun, looking for the length of pipe, diving for it, and crawling on hands and knees, and here, here, and coming up to see Ross reach down, getting one hand into Clifton's collar, and the knife in the other, looking down at Clifton and panting, bull angry. I froze, seeing him draw back the knife and stop it in midair, draw back and stop, cursing, then draw back and stop again, all very quickly beginning to cry now, and talking rapidly at the same time, and me easing slowly forward. Man, Ross blurted, I ought to kill you, goddamn, I ought to kill you, and the world would be better off. But you, black man, why you be black man? I swear I ought to kill you. No man strike the Exhorter, God damn it, no man! I saw him raise the knife again, and now, as he lowered it unused, he pushed Clifton into the street and stood over him, sobbing. Why are you with these white folks? Why? I've been watching you a long time. I say to myself, soon he get smart and get tired and get out of that thing. Why a good boy let you still with them? Still moving forward, I saw his face gleam with red angry tears as he stood above Clifton with the still innocent knife, and the tears red in the glow of the window sign. You my brother, man. Brothers are the same color. How the hell you call these white men brother? Shit, man. That's shit. Brothers the same color. We sons of Mama Africa, you done forgot. You black, black, you God damn man, he said, swinging the knife for emphasis. You got bad hair, you got thick lips. They say you stink, they hate you, man. You African, African, why you with them? Leave that shit, man. They sell you out. That shit is old-fashioned. They enslave us. You forget that. How can they mean a black man any good? How they going to be your brother? I had reached him now and brought the pipe down hard, seeing the knife fly off into the dark as he grabbed his wrist. And I raised the pipe again, suddenly hot with fear and hate, as he looked at me out of his narrow little eyes, standing his ground. And you, man, the exhorter said, a regular little black devil, a goddamn sly mongoose. Where you think you from? Going with the white folks. I know, goddamn, don't I know. You from down south. You from Trinidad. You from Barbados, Jamaica, South Africa, and the white man's foot in your ass all the way to the hip. What are you trying to deny by betraying the black people? Why you fight against us? You young fellas, you young black men with plenty education. I've been hearing your rabble-rousing. Why you go over to the enslaver? What kind of education is that? What kind of black man is that who betray his own mama? Shut up, Clifton said, leaping to his feet. Shut up! Hell no, Ross cried, wiping his eyes with his fist. I talk... Bust me with the pipe, but by God, you listen to the exhorter. Come in with us, man. We build a glorious movement of black people. Black people! What they do, give you money. Who want the damn stuff? Their money bleed black blood, man. It's unclean. Taking their money is shit, man. Money without dignity, that's bad shit. Clifton lunged toward him. I held him, shaking my head. Come on, the man's crazy, I said, pulling on his arm. Ross struck his thighs with his fist. Me crazy, man? You call me crazy? Look at you two and look at me. Is this sanity? Standing here in three shades of blackness, three black men fighting in the street because of the white enslaver, is that sanity? Is that consciousness, scientific understanding? Is that the modern black man of the 20th century? Hell, man, is that self-respect, black against black? What they give you to betray, hmm? They're women, hmm? You fall for that? Let's go, I said, listening and remembering and suddenly alive in the dark with the horror of the battle royal. But Clifton looked at Ross with a tight, fascinated expression, pulling away from me. Let's go, I repeated. He stood there, looking. Sure, you go, Ross said, but not him. You contaminated, but he the real black man. In Africa, this man be a chief, a black king. Here they say he raped them goddamn women with no blood in their veins. I bet this man can't beat them off with baseball bat. Shit. What kind of foolishness is it? Kick him ass from cradle to grave, then call him brother. Does it make mathematics? Is it logical? Look at him, man. Open your eyes, he said to me. I look like that. I rock the blasted world. They know about me and Japan, India, all the colored countries, youth, intelligence, the man's natural prince. Where's your eyes? Where's your self-respect working for them damn people? The days is numbered. The time is almost here and you fooling round like this was the 19th century. You don't understand you. Am I ignorant? Answer me, man. Yes, Clifton burst out. Hell yes. You think I'm crazy? Is it 'cause I speak bad English? Hell, it ain't my mama tongue, man. I'm African. You really think I'm crazy? Yes, yes! You believe that, said Ross. What they do to you, black man? Give you them stinking women? Clifton lunged again, and again I grabbed him, and again Ross held his ground, his head glowing red. Women? God damn, man, is that equality? Is that the black man's freedom? A pat on the back and a piece of cunt without no passion. Maggots. They buy you that blasted cheap, man. What they do to my people? Where's your brains, these women dregs, man? They bile water. You know, the high-class white man hates the black man. That's simple. So now he uses the dregs and want you black men to do his dirty work. They betray you, and you betray the black people. They're tricking you, man. Let them fight amongst themselves. Let them kill one another. We organize. Organization is good, but we organize black, black. To hell with that son of a bitch, hey. He take one of them strumpets and tell the black man his freedom lie between his skinny legs, while that son of a gun, he take all the power and the capital and don't leave the black man nothing. And the good white women, he tell the black man is a rapist and keep them locked up and ignorant while he makes the black man a race of bastards. When the black man gonna tire this childish perfidy? They got you so you don't trust your black intelligence. You young, don't play yourself cheap, man. Don't deny yourself. It took 1 billion gallons of black blood to make you recognize yourself inside, and you want the kings among men. A man knows he's a man when he's got nothing, when he's naked. Nobody have to tell him that. You 6-foot-tall man. You young and intelligent. You black and beautiful. And don't let him tell you different. You wasn't them things, you'd be dead, man. Dead. I'd have killed you, man. Ras the Exhorter raised up his knife and tried to do it, but he could not do it. Why don't you do it, I ask myself. I will do it now, I say. But something tell me, no, no, no. You might be killing your black king. And I say, yes, yes, oh, I accept your humiliating action. Ras, recognize your black possibilities, man. Ras would not sacrifice his black brother to the white enslaver. Instead, he cry. Ras is a man, no white man, I have to tell him that. And Ras cry. So why don't you recognize your black duty, man, and come join us? His chest was heaving, and a note of pleading had come into the harsh voice. He was an exhorter, all right, and I was caught in the crude, insane eloquence of his plea. He stood there, awaiting an answer. And suddenly a big transport plane came low over the buildings, and I looked up to see the firing of its engine. And we were all three silent, watching. Suddenly the exhorter shook his fist toward the plane and yelled, "Hell with him! Some day we have them too! Hell with him!" He stood there, shaking his fist as the plane rattled the buildings in its powerful flight. Then it was gone, and I looked about the unreal street. They were fighting far up the block in the dark now, and we were alone. I looked at the exhorter. I didn't know if I were angry or amazed. "Look," I said, shaking my head, let's talk sense. From now on, we'll be on the street corners every night and we'll be prepared for trouble. We don't want it, especially with you, but we won't run either." "God damn, man," he said, leaping forward. "This is Harlem. This is my territory. The black man's territory. You think we let white folk come in and spread their poison? Let them come in like they come and take over the numbers racket, like they have all the stores? Talk sense, man. If you're talking to Ras, talk sense." "This is sense," I said. "And you listen as we listen to you. We'll be out here every night, you understand? We'll be out here, and the next time you go after one of our brothers with a knife, and I mean white or black, well, we won't forget it." He shook his head. "Nor will I forget you either, man." "Don't. I don't want you to. Because if you forget, there'll be trouble." "You're mistaken. Don't you see you're outnumbered? You need allies to win. That there is sense. Black allies, yellow and brown allies. All men who want a brotherly world," I said. "Don't be stupid, man. They white. They don't have to be allies with no black people. They get what they want, they turn against you. Where's your black intelligence?" "Thinking like that will get you lost in the backwash of history," I said. "Start thinking with your mind and not your emotions." He shook his head vehemently, looking at Clifton. "This black man talking to me about brains and thinking. I ask both of you, are you awake or sleeping? What is your past and where are you going? Never mind. Take your corrupt ideology and eat out your own guts like a laughing hyena. You are nowhere, man. Nowhere. Ras is not ignorant, nor is Ras afraid. No. Ras be here, black, and fighting for the liberty of the black people when the white folks have got what they want and done gone off laughing in your face and you stinking and choked up with white maggots." He spat angrily into the dark street. It flew pink in the red glow. "That'll be all right with me," I said. "Only remember what I said." Come on, Brother Clifton. This man's full of pus. Black pus. We started away, a piece of glass crunching under my foot. Maybe so, Ross said, but I am no fool. I am no black educated fool who thinks everything between black man and white man can be settled with some blasted lies and some bloody books written by the white man in the first place. It's 300 years of black blood to build this white man's civilization and won't be wiped out in a minute. Blood calls for blood. You remember that? And remember that I am not like you. Ross recognizes the true issues and he is not afraid to be black. Nor is he a traitor for white men. Remember that? I am no black traitor to the black people for the white people. And before I could answer, Clifton spun in the dark, and there was a crack, and I saw Ross go down, and Clifton breathing hard, and Ross lying there in the street, a thick black man with red tears on his face that caught the reflection of the checks cashed here sign. And again, as Clifton looked gravely down, he seemed to ask a silent question. Let's go, I said. Let's go. We started away as the screams of sirens sounded, Clifton cursing quietly to himself. Then we were out of the dark, onto a busy street, and he turned to me. There were tears in his eyes. That poor misguided son of a bitch, he said. He thinks a lot of you, too, I said. I was glad to be out of the dark and away from that exhorting voice. Man's crazy, Clifton said. It'll run you crazy if you let it. Where'd he get that name, I said. He gave it to himself. I guess he did. Ross is a title of respect in the East. It's one he didn't say something about Ethiopia stretching forth her wings, he said, mimicking Ross. He makes it sound like the hood of a cobra fluttering. I don't know. I don't know. We'll have to watch him now, I said. Yeah, we better, he said. He won't stop fighting. And thanks for getting rid of his knife. You didn't have to worry, I said. He wouldn't kill his king. He turned and looked at me as though he thought I might mean it. Then he smiled. For a while there, I thought I was gone, he said. As we headed for the district office, I wondered what Brother Jack would say about the fight. We'll have to overpower him with organization, I said. We'll do that, all right. But it's on the inside that Ross is strong, Clifton said. On the inside, he's dangerous. He won't get on the inside, I said. He'd consider himself a traitor. No, Clifton said. He won't get on the inside. Did you hear how he was talking? Did you hear what he was saying? I heard him, sure, I said. I don't know, he said. I suppose sometimes a man has to plunge outside history.
What?
Plunge outside, turn his back. Otherwise, he might kill somebody, go nuts. I didn't answer. Maybe he's right, I thought, and was suddenly very glad I had found brotherhood. The next morning it rained, and I reached the district before the others arrived and stood looking through the window of my office, past the jutting wall of a building and on beyond the monotonous pattern of its bricks and mortar. I saw a row of trees rising tall and graceful in the rain. One tree grew close by, and I could see the rain streaking its bark and its sticky buds. Trees were rowed the length of the long block beyond me, rising tall in dripping wetness above a series of cluttered backyards. And it occurred to me that, cleared of its ramshackle fences and planted with flowers and grass, it might form a pleasant park. And just then, a paper bag sailed from a window to my left and burst like a silent grenade, scattering garbage into the trees and pancaking to the earth with a soggy, exhausted plop. I started with disgust, then thought, the sun will shine in those backyards someday. A community cleanup campaign might be worthwhile for a slack season at that. Everything couldn't possibly be as exciting as last night. Turning back to my desk, I sat facing the map now, as Brother Tarp appeared.
"Morning, son. I see you already on the job," he said.
"Good morning. I have so much to do that I thought I'd better get started early," I said.
You do all right, he said. But I didn't come in here to take up your time. I want to put something on the wall.
Go right ahead. Can I give you a hand?
No, I can make it all right,
he said, clambering with his lame leg upon a chair that sat beneath the map and hanging a frame from the ceiling molding, straightening it carefully, and getting down to come over beside my desk.
Son, you know who that is?
Why, yes, I said, it's Frederick Douglass.
Yes, sir, that's just who it is.
You know much about him?
Well, not much.
My grandfather used to tell me about him, though.
That's enough. He was a great man. You just take a look at him once in a while. You have everything you need? Paper and stuff like that?
Yes, I have, Brother Tarp. And thanks for the portrait of Douglass.
Don't thank me, son, he said from the door. He belongs to all of us.
I sat now facing the portrait of Frederick Douglass, feeling a sudden piety, remembering and refusing to hear the echoes of my grandfather's voice. Then I picked up the telephone and began calling the community leaders. They fell in line like prisoners, preachers, politicians, various professionals, proving Clifton correct. The eviction fight was such a dramatic issue that most of the leaders feared that their followers would have rallied to us without them. I slighted no one, no matter how unimportant. Big shots, doctors, real estate men, and storefront preachers. And it went so fast and smoothly that it seemed not to happen to me, but to someone who actually bore my new name. I almost laughed into the phone when I heard the director of Men's House address me with profound respect. My new name was getting around. It's very strange, I thought, but things are so unreal for them normally that they believe that to call a thing by name is to make it so. And yet, I am what they think I am. Our work went so well that a few Sundays later, we threw a parade that clinched our hold on the community. We worked feverishly, and now the clashing and conflict of my last days at Mary's seemed to have moved out into the struggles of the community, leaving me inwardly calm and controlled. Even the hustle and bustle of picketing and speech-making seemed to stimulate me for the better. My wildest ideas paid off. Upon hearing that one of the unemployed brothers was an ex-drill master from Wichita, Kansas, I organized a drill team of six-footers whose duty it was to march through the streets striking up sparks with their hobnailed shoes. On the day of the parade, they drew crowds faster than a dogfight on a country road. The people's hot foot squad, we called them, and when they drilled fancy formations down 7th Avenue in the springtime dusk, they set the streets ablaze. The community laughed and cheered, and the police were dumbfounded. But the sheer corn of it got them, and the Hotfoot squad went shuffling along. Then came the flags and banners and the cards bearing slogans, and the squad of drum majorettes, the best-looking girls we could find, who pranced and twirled and just plain girled in the enthusiastic interest of brotherhood. We pulled 15,000 Harlemites into the street behind our slogans and marched down Broadway to City Hall. Indeed, we were the talk of the town. With a success, I was pushed forward at a dizzy pace. My name spread like smoke in an airless room. I was kept moving all over the place, speeches here, there, everywhere, uptown and down. I wrote newspaper articles, led parades and relief delegations, and so on, and the Brotherhood was going out of its way to make my name prominent. Articles, telegrams, and many mailings went out over my signature, some of which I'd written, but most not. I was publicized, identified with the organization both by word and image in the press. On the way to work one late spring morning, I counted 50 greetings from people I didn't know, becoming aware that there were two of me. The old self that slept a few hours a night and dreamed sometimes of my grandfather and Bledsoe and Brockway and Mary, the self that flew without wings and plunged from great heights, and the new public self that spoke for the Brotherhood and was becoming so much more important than the other that I seemed to run a foot race against myself. Still, I liked my work during those days of certainty. I kept my eyes wide and ears alert. The Brotherhood was a world within a world, and I was determined to discover all its secrets and to advance as far as I could. I saw no limits. It was the one organization in the whole country in which I could reach the very top, and I meant to get there, even if it meant climbing a mountain of words. For now I had begun to believe, despite all the talk of science around me, that there was a magic in spoken words. Sometimes I sat watching the watery play of light upon Douglas's portrait, thinking how magical it was that he had talked his way from slavery to a government ministry, and so swiftly. Perhaps, I thought, something of the kind is happening to me. Douglas came north to escape and find work in the shipyards, a big fellow in a sailor suit who, like me, had taken another name. What had his true name, then? Whatever it was as Douglas that he became himself, defined himself, not as a boatwright as he'd expected, but as an orator. Perhaps the sense of magic lay in the unexpected transformations. You start Saul and end up Paul, my grandfather had often said. When you're a young'un, you Saul, but let life whoop your head a bit and you starts to tryin' to be Paul, though you still Saul's around on the side. No, you could never tell where you were going. That was a sure thing, the only sure thing. Nor could you tell how you'd get there, though when you arrived it was somehow right. For hadn't I started out with a speech? And hadn't it been a speech that won my scholarship to college, where I had expected speech-making to win me a place with Bledsoe and launch me finally as national leader? Well, I had made a speech, and it had made me a leader, only not the kind I had expected. So that was the way it was. And no complaints, I thought, looking at the map. You started looking for red men, and you found them, even though of a different tribe and in a bright new world. The world was strange, if you stopped to think about it. Still, it was a world that could be controlled by science, and the Brotherhood had both science and history under control. Thus, for one lone stretch of time, I lived with the intensity displayed by those chronic numbers players who see clues to their fortune in the most minute and insignificant phenomena. In clouds, on passing trucks and subway cars, in dreams, comic strips, the shape of dog luck fouled on the pavements, I was dominated by the all-embracing idea of brotherhood. The organization had given the world a new shape, and me a vital role. We recognized no loose ends. Everything could be controlled by our science. Life was all pattern and discipline, and the beauty of discipline is when it works, and it was working very well. Only my Bledsoe trustee-inspired compulsion to read all papers that touched my hands prevented me from throwing the envelope aside. It was unstamped and appeared to be the least important item in the morning's mail. Brother, this is advice from a friend who has been watching you closely. Do not go too fast. Keep working for the people, but remember that you are one of us. And do not forget, if you get too big, they will cut you down. You are from the South, and you know that this is a white man's world. So take a friendly advice and go easy, so that you can keep on helping the colored people. They don't want you to go too fast, and will cut you down if you do. Be smart. I shot to my feet, the paper rattling poisonously in my hands. What did it mean? Who'd send such a thing? Brother Tarp, I called, reading again the wavery lines of a handwriting that was somehow familiar. Brother Tarp! What is it, son? And looking up, I received another shock. Framed there in the gray, early morning light of the door, my grandfather seemed to look from his eyes. I gave a quick gasp. Then there was a silence in which I could hear his wheezing breath as he eyed me unperturbed. "What's wrong?" he said, limping into the room. I reached for the envelope. "Where did this come from?" I said. "What is it?" he said, taking it calmly from my hands. "It's unstamped.
Oh, yes. I saw it myself, he said. I reckon somebody put it in the box late last night. I took it out with the regular mail. Is it something that wasn't for you?
No, I said, avoiding his eyes. But it isn't dated. I was wondering when it arrived. Why are you staring at me?
Because it looks to me like you've seen a ghost. You feel sick?
It's nothing, I said. Just a slight upset. There was an awkward silence. He stood there, and I forced myself to look at his eyes again, finding my grandfather gone, leaving only the searching calm. I said, sit down a second, Brother Tarp. Since you're here, I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure, he said, dropping into the chair. Go ahead.
Brother Tarp, you get around and know the members. How do they really feel about me? He cocked his head.
Why, sure. They think you're going to make a real leader.
But?
Ain't no buts. That's what they think. And I don't mind telling you.
But what about the others?
What others?
The ones who don't think so much of me.
Them's the ones I haven't heard about, son.
I must have some enemies, I said.
Sure, I guess everybody has them, but I never heard of anybody here in the Brotherhood not liking you. As far as folks up here is concerned, they think you're it. You heard any different?
No, but I was wondering. I've been going along taking them so much for granted that I thought I'd better check so that I can keep their support.
Well, you don't have to worry. So far, nearly everything you had anything to do with has turned out to be what the folks like. Even things some of them resisted. Take that there, he said, pointing to the wall near my desk.
It was a symbolic poster of a group of heroic figures, an American Indian couple representing the dispossessed past, a blonde brother in overalls, and a leading Irish sister representing the dispossessed present, and Brother Todd Clifton and a young white couple. It had been felt unwise simply to show Clifton and the girl, surrounded by a group of children of mixed races representing the future, a color photograph of bright skin texture and smooth contrast. So, I said, staring at the legend. After the struggle, the rainbow of America's future.
Well, when you first suggested it, some of the members was against you.
Well, that's certainly true.
Sure, they raised the devil about the youth members going into the subways and sticking them up in place of them constipation ads and things. But you know what they're doing now?
I guess they're holding it against me because some of the kids were arrested, I said.
Holding it against you? Hell, they're going around bragging about it. But what I was about to say is they're taking them rainbow pictures and tacking them up to their walls along with God Bless Our Home and the Lord's Prayer. They're crazy about it. The same way with the hot footers and all that. You don't have to worry, son. They might resist some of your ideas, but when the deal goes down, they with you right on down to the ground. The only enemies you likely to have is somebody on the outside who's jealous to see you spring up all of a sudden and start doing some of the things what should have been done years ago. And what do you care when some folks start knocking you? It's a sign you're getting someplace.
I'd like to believe so, Brother Tarp, I said. As long as I have the people with me, I'll believe in what I'm doing.
That's right, he said. When things get rough, it kind of helps to know you got support.
His voice broke off, and he seemed to stare down at me, although he faced me at eye level across the desk. What is it, Brother Tarp?
You from down south, ain't you, son?
Yes, I said. He turned in his chair, sliding one hand into his pocket as he rested his chin upon the other.
I don't really have words to say what just come into my head, son. You see, I was down there for a long time before I come up here. And when I did come up, it was after me. What I mean is, I had to escape. I had to come a-running.
I guess I did, too, in a way, I said.
You mean they were after you, too?
Not really, Brother Tarp. I just feel that way.
But this ain't exactly the same thing, he said. You notice this limp I got?
Yes.
Well, I wasn't always lame, and I'm not really now, 'cause the doctors can't find anything wrong with that leg. They say it's sound as a piece of steel. What I mean is, I got this limp from dragging a chain.
I couldn't see it in his face or hear it in his speech, yet I knew he was neither lying nor trying to shock me. I shook my head.
Sure, he said.
Nobody knows that about me. They just thinks I got rheumatism. But it was the chain, and after 19 years, I haven't been able to stop dragging my leg. 19 years. 19 years, 6 months, and 2 days. And what I did wasn't much. That is, it wasn't much when I did it. But after all that time, it changed into something else, and it seemed to be as bad as they said it was. All that time made it bad. I paid for it with everything I had but my life. I lost my wife and my boys and my piece of land. So what started out as an argument between a couple of men turned out to be a crime worth 19 years of my life. What on earth did you do, Brother Tarn? I said no to a man who wanted to take something from me. That's what it cost me, for saying no. And even now the debt ain't fully paid and will never be paid in their terms. A pain throbbed in my throat and I felt a kind of numb despair. 19 years. And here he was talking quietly to me, and this, no doubt, the first time he'd try to tell anyone about it. But why me, I thought. Why pick me? I said no, he said. I said hell no. And I kept saying no until I broke the chain and left. But how? They let me get close to the dogs once in a while. That's how. I made friends with them dogs and I waited. Down there you really learn how to wait. I waited 19 years, and then one morning when the river was flooding, I left. They thought I was one of them who got drowned when the levee broke. But I done broke the chain and gone. I was standing in the mud holding a long-handled shovel and I asked myself, Tart, can you make it? And inside me I said, yes. All that water and mud and rain said yes, and I took off. Suddenly he gave a laugh so gay it startled me. I'm telling it better than I ever thought I could, he said, fishing in his pocket and removing something that looked like an oilskin tobacco pouch, from which he removed an object wrapped in a handkerchief. I've been looking for freedom ever since, son, and sometimes I've done all right. Up to these here hard times, I did very well, considering that I'm a man whose health is not too good. But even when times were best for me, I remembered, because I didn't want to forget those 19 years. I just kind of held on to this as a keepsake and a reminder. He was unwrapping the object now, and I watched his old man's hands. I'd like to pass it on to you, son. There, he said, handing it to me. Funny thing to give somebody, but I think it's got a heap of signifying wrapped up in it, and it might help you remember what we're really fighting against. I don't think of it in terms of but two words, yes and no, but it signifies a heap more. I saw him place his hand on the desk. Brother, he said, calling me brother for the first time, I want you to take it. I guess it's a kind of luck piece. Anyway, it's the one I filed to get away. I took it in my hand, a thick, dark, oily piece of filed steel that had been twisted open and forced partly back into place, on which I saw marks that might have been made by the blade of a hatchet. It was such a link as I had seen on Bledsoe's desk, only while that one had been smooth, Tarp's bore the marks of haste and violence, looking as though it had been attacked and conquered before it stubbornly yielded. I looked at him and shook my head as he watched me inscrutably. Finding no words to ask him more about it, I slipped the link over my knuckles and struck it sharply against the desk. Brother Tarp chuckled.
Well, now there's a way I never thought of using it, he said. It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
But why do you give it to me, Brother Tarp?
Because I have to, I guess. And I don't go trying to get me to say what I can't. You're the talker, not me, he said, getting up and limping toward the door. It was lucky to me, and I think it might be lucky to you. You just keep it with you and look at it once in a while. Of course, if you get tired of it, why, give it back.
Oh, no, I called after him. I want it, and I think I understand. Thanks for giving it to me. I looked at the dark band of metal against my fist and dropped it upon the anonymous letter. I neither wanted it nor knew what to do with it. Although there was no question of keeping it, if for no other reason than that I felt that Brother Tarp's gesture in offering it was of some deeply felt significance which I was compelled to respect. Something perhaps like a man passing on to his son his own father's watch, which the son accepted not because he wanted the old-fashioned timepiece for itself, but because of the overtones of unstated seriousness and solemnity of the paternal gesture, which at once joined him with his ancestors, marked a high point of his present, and promised a concreteness to the nebulous and chaotic future. And now, I remember that if I had returned home instead of coming north, my father would have given me my grandfather's old-fashioned Hamilton, with its long, burr-headed winding stem. Well, so my brother would get it, and I'd never wanted it anyway. What were they doing now? I brooded, suddenly sick for home. I could feel the air from the window hot against my neck, as through the smell of morning coffee I heard a throaty voice singing with a mixture of laughter and solemnity. Don't come early in the morning, neither in the heat of the day, but come in the sweet cool of the evening and wash my sins away. A whole series of memories started to well up, but I threw them off. There was no time for memory, for all its images were of times past. There had only been a few minutes from the time that I'd called in Brother Tarp about the letter and his leaving, but it seemed as though I'd plunged down a well of years. I looked calmly now at the writing, which, for a moment, had shaken my total structure of certainty, and was glad that Brother Tarp had been there to be called rather than Clifton or some of the others before whom I would have been ashamed of my panic. Instead, he'd left me soberly confident. Perhaps from the shock of seeming to see my grandfather looking through Tarp's eyes, perhaps through the calmness of his voice alone, or perhaps through his story and his link of chain, he had restored my perspective. He's right, I thought. Whoever sent the message is trying to confuse me. Some enemy is trying to halt our progress by destroying my faith through touching upon my old southern distrust, our fear of white betrayal. It was as though he had learned of my experience with Bledsoe's letters and was trying to use that knowledge to destroy not only me, but the whole Brotherhood. Yet that was impossible. No one knew that story who knew me now. It was simply an obscene coincidence. If only I could get my hands upon his stupid throat. Here in the Brotherhood was the one place in the country where we were free and given the greatest encouragement to use our abilities, and he was trying to destroy it. No, it wasn't me he was worrying about becoming too big. It was the Brotherhood. And becoming big was exactly what the Brotherhood wanted. Hadn't I just received orders to submit ideas for organizing more people? And a white man's world was just what the Brotherhood was against. We were dedicated to building a world of brotherhood. But who had sent it? Ross the Exhorter? No, it wasn't like him. He was more direct and absolutely against any collaboration between blacks and whites. It was someone else, someone more insidious than Ross. But who, I wondered, forcing it below my consciousness as I turned to the tasks at hand. The morning began with people asking my advice on how to secure relief, members coming in for instructions for small committee meetings being held in corners of the large hall. And I had just dismissed a woman seeking to free her husband who had been jailed for beating her, when Brother Restrum entered the room. I returned his greeting and watched him ease into a chair, his eyes sweeping over my desk with uneasiness. He seemed to possess some kind of authority in the Brotherhood, but his exact function was unclear. He was, I felt, something of a meddler. And hardly had he settled himself when he stared at my desk, saying, "What you got there, brother?" and pointed toward a pile of my papers. I leaned slowly back in my chair, looking him in the eye. "That's my work," I said coldly, determined to stop any interference from the start. "But I mean that," he said, pointing, his eyes beginning to blaze. "That there." "It's work," I said, "all my work." "Is that too?" he said, pointing to Brother Tarp's leg link. "Oh, that's just a personal present, brother," I said. "What could I do for you?" "That ain't what I asked you, brother. What is it?" I picked up the link and held it toward him, the metal oily and strangely skin-like now, with the slanting sun entering the window. "Would you care to examine it, brother? One of our members wore it 19 years on the chain gang." "Hell no," he recoiled. "I mean, no thank you. In fact, brother, I don't think we ought to have such things around." "You think so?" I said. "And just why?"
because I don't think we ought to dramatize our differences. I'm not dramatizing anything. It's my personal property that happens to be lying on my desk. But people can see it. That's true, I said, but I think it's a good reminder of what our movement is fighting against. No, sir, he said, shaking his head. No, sir. That's the worst kind of thing for the Brotherhood, because we want to make folks think of the things we have in common. That's what makes for Brotherhood. We have to change this way we have of always talking about how different we are. In the Brotherhood, we are all brothers. I was amused. He was obviously disturbed by something deeper than a need to forget differences. Fear was in his eyes. I never thought of it just that way, brother, I said, dangling the iron between my finger and thumb. But you want to think about it, he said. We have to discipline ourselves. Things that don't make for brotherhood have to be rooted out. We have enemies, you know. I watch everything I do and say so as to be sure that I don't upset the brotherhood, because this is a wonderful movement, brother, and we have to keep it that way. We have to watch ourselves, brother. You know what I mean? Too often we are liable to forget that this is something that's a privilege to belong to. We're liable to say things that don't do nothing but make for more misunderstanding. What's driving him, I thought. What's all this to do with me? Could he have sent me the note? Dropping the iron, I fished for the anonymous note from beneath the pile and held it by a corner so that the slanting sun shone through the page and outlined the scrawling letters. I watched him intently. He was leaning upon the desk now, looking at the page, but with no recognition in his eyes. I dropped the page upon the chain, more disappointed than relieved. "Between you and me, brother," he said, "there are those amongst us who don't really believe in the Brotherhood." "Oh? You damn right they don't. They're just in it to use it for their own ends. Some call you brother to your face, and the minute you turn your back, you're a black son of a bitch. You got to watch 'em." "I haven't encountered any of that, brother," I said. "You will. There's lots of poison around. Some don't want to shake your hand, and some don't like the idea of seeing too much of you. But God damn it, in the Brotherhood, they got to." I looked at him. It had never occurred to me that the Brotherhood could force anyone to shake my hand, and that he found satisfaction that it could was both shocking and distasteful. Suddenly, he laughed. "Yes, goddammit, they gotta. Me, I don't let 'em get away with nothing. If they're gonna be brothers, let 'em be brothers. Oh, but I'm fair," he said, his face suddenly self-righteous. "I'm fair. I ask myself every day, what are you doing against brotherhood? And when I find it, I root it out. I burn it like a man cauterizing a mad dog bite. This business of being a brother is a full-time job. You have to be pure in heart, and you have to be disciplined in body and mind. Brother, you understand what I mean?" "Yes, I think I do," I said. "Some folks feel that way about their religion." "Religion?" He blinked his eyes. "Folks like me and you is full of distrust," he said. "We've been corrupted till it's hard for some of us to believe in brotherhood. And some even want revenge. That's what I'm talking about. We have to root it out. We have to learn to trust our other brothers. After all, didn't they start the brotherhood? Didn't they come and stretch out their hand to us black men and say, 'We want y'all for our brothers'? Didn't they do it? Didn't they now? Didn't they set out to organize us and help fight our battle and all like that? Sure they did. And we have to remember it 24 hours a day. Brotherhood. That's the word we got to keep right in front of our eyes every second. Now, this brings me to why I come to see you, brother." He sat back, his huge hands grasping his knees. "I got a plan I want to talk over with you." "Well, what is it, brother?" I said. "Well, it's like this. I think we ought to have some way of showing what we are. We ought to have some banners and things like that, especially for us black brothers." "I see," I said, becoming interested. "But why do you think this is important?"
"'Cause it helps the brotherhood, that's why. First, if you remember, when you watch our people, when there's a parade or a funeral or a dance or anything like that, they always have some kind of flags and banners, even if they don't mean anything. It kind of makes the occasion seem more important like. It makes people stop, look, and listen. What's coming off here? But you know and I know that they ain't none of them got no true flag, except maybe Ross the Exhorter, and he claims he's Ethiopian or African. But none of us got no true flag, because that flag don't really belong to us. They want a true flag,
One that's as much theirs as anybody else's. You know what I mean?
Yes. I think I do, I said, remembering that there was always that sense in me of being apart when the flag went by. It had been a reminder until I'd found the Brotherhood that my star was not yet there.
Sure you know, Brother Restrom said. Everybody wants a flag. We need a flag that stands for Brotherhood, and we need a sign we can wear.
A sign? You know, a pin or a button.
You mean an emblem?
That's it. Something we can wear, a pin or something like that, so that when a brother meets a brother, they can know it. That way that thing what happened to Brother Todd Clifton wouldn't have happened.
What wouldn't have happened? He sat back.
Don't you know about it?
I don't know what you mean.
It's something that's best forgot about, he said,
leaning close, his big hands gripped and stretched before him.
But you see, there was a rally, and some hoodlums tried to break up the meeting. And in the fighting, Brother Todd Clifton got hold to one of the white brothers by mistake and was beating him. Thought he was one of the hoodlums, he said. Things like that is bad, brother. Very bad. But with some of these emblems, things like that wouldn't happen.
So that actually happened, I said?
Sure did. That Brother Clifton goes wild when he gets mad. But what do you think of my idea?
I think it should be brought to the attention of the committee, I said guardedly as the phone rang. Excuse me for a moment, brother, I said. It was the editor of a new picture magazine requesting an interview of
one of our most successful young men.
That's very flattering, I said, but I'm afraid I'm too busy for an interview. I suggest, however, that you interview our youth leader, Brother Todd Clifton. You'll find him a much more interesting subject.
No, no, Restrom said, shaking his head violently as the editor said. But we want you.
And you know, I interrupted, our work is considered very controversial, certainly by some.
That's exactly why we want you. You've become identified with that controversy, and it's our job to bring such subjects to the eyes of our readers.
But so is Brother Clifton, I said.
No, sir. You're the man, and you owe it to our youth to allow us to tell them your story, he said as I watched Brother Restrom leaning forward. We feel that they should be encouraged to keep fighting toward success. After all, you are one of the latest to fight his way to the top. We need all the heroes we can get.
But please, I laughed over the phone, I'm no hero, and I'm far from the top. I'm a cog in a machine. We here in the Brotherhood work as a unit, I said, seeing Brother Restrom nod his head in agreement.
But you can't get around the fact that you're the first of our people to attract attention to it, can you now?
Brother Clifton was active at least 3 years before me. Besides, it isn't that simple. Individuals don't count for very much. It's what the group wants, what the group does. Everyone here submerges his personal ambitions for the common achievement.
Good. That's very good. People want to hear that. All people need to have someone say that to them. Why don't you let me send out an interviewer? I'll have her there in 20 minutes.
You're very insistent, but I'm very busy, I said. And if Brother Restrom hadn't been wig-wagging trying to tell me what to say, I would have refused. Instead, I consented. Perhaps, I thought, a little friendly publicity wouldn't hurt. Such a magazine would reach many timid souls living far from the sound of our voices. I had only to remember to say little about my past. I'm sorry for this interruption, brother, I said, putting down the phone and looking into his curious eyes. I'll bring your idea to the attention of the committee as quickly as possible. I stood to discourage further talk, and he got up, fairly bursting to continue.
Well, I've got to see some other brothers myself, he said. I'll be seeing you soon.
Anytime, I said, avoiding his hand by picking up some papers. Going out, he turned with his hand on the doorframe, frowning.
And brother, don't forget what I said about that thing you got on your desk. Things like that don't do nothing but cause confusion. They ought to be kept out of sight.
I was glad to see him go. The idea of his trying to tell me what to say in a conversation, only part of which he could have heard. And it was obvious that he disliked Clifton. Well, I disliked him, and all that foolishness and fear over the leg chain. Tarp had worn it for 19 years and could laugh, but this big... Then I forgot Brother Restrom until about 2 weeks later at our downtown headquarters, where a meeting had been called to discuss strategy. Everyone had arrived before me. Long benches were arranged at one side of the room, which was hot and filled with smoke. Usually such meetings sounded like a prize fight or a smoker. But now everyone was silent. The White brothers looked uncomfortable and some of the Harlan brothers belligerent. Nor did they leave me time to think about it. No sooner had I apologized for my lateness than Brother Jack struck the table with his gavel, addressing his first remarks to me.
"Brother, there seems to be a serious misunderstanding among some of the brothers concerning your work and recent conduct," he said.
I stared at him blankly, my mind groping for connections. "I'm sorry, Brother Jack," I said, "but I don't understand. Do you mean there's something wrong with my work?"
"So it seems," he said, his face completely neutral.
"Certain charges have been made."
"Charges? Have I failed to carry out some directive?" "About that there seems to be some doubt, but we'd better let Brother Restrum speak of this," he said.
"Brother Restrum?" I was shocked. He hadn't been around since our talk, and I looked across the table into his evasive face, seeing him stand with a slouch, a rolled paper protruding from his pocket.
"Yes, brothers," he said, "I brought charges, much as I hated to have to do it. But I've been watching the way things have been going, and I decided that if they don't stop soon, this brother is going to make a fool out of the brotherhood."
There were some sounds of protest.
"Yes, I said it, and I mean it. This here brother constitutes one of the greatest dangers ever confronted by our movement."
I looked at Brother Jack. His eyes were sparkling. I seemed to see traces of a smile as he scribbled something on a pad. I was becoming very hot.
"Be more specific, brother," Brother Garnett, a White brother, said. "These are serious charges, and we all know that the brother's work has been splendid. Be specific."
"Sure, I'll be specific," Restrum boomed, suddenly whipping the paper from his pocket, unrolling it, and throwing it on the table. "This here's what I mean."
I took a step forward. It was a portrait of me, looking out from a magazine page. "Where did that come from?" I said.
"That's it," he boomed. "Make out like you never seen it."
"But I haven't," I said. "I really haven't."
"Don't lie to these White brothers. Don't lie."
"I'm not lying. I never saw it before in my life. But suppose I had. What's wrong with it?"
"You know what's wrong," Restrum said.
"Look, I don't know anything. What's on your mind? You have us all here, so if you have anything to say, please get it over with."
"Brothers, this is a opportunist. All you got to do is read this article to see. I charge this man with using the Brotherhood movement to advance his own selfish interests."
Article? Then I remembered the interview, which I had forgotten. I met the eyes of the others as they looked from me to Restrum.
"And what does it say about us?" Brother Jack said, pointing to the magazine.
"Say," Restrum said, "doesn't say anything. It's all about him. What he thinks, what he does, what he's going to do. Not a word about the rest of us who's been building the movement before he was ever heard of. Look at it. If you think I'm lying, look at it."
Brother Jack turned to me.
"Is this true?"
I haven't read it," I said. I had forgotten that I was interviewed.
"But you remember it now," Brother Jack said.
"Yes, I do now, and he happened to be in the office when the appointment was made." They were silent.
"Hell, Brother Jack," Restrum said, "is right here in black and white. He's trying to give people the idea that he's the whole Brotherhood movement."
"I'm doing nothing of the sort. I tried to get the editor to interview Brother Todd Clifton. You know that. Since you know so little about what I'm doing, why not tell the brothers what you're up to?"
"I'm exposing a double dealer. That's what I'm doing. I'm exposing you. Brothers, this man is a pure D opportunist."
"All right," I said. "Expose me if you can, but stop the slander."
"I'll expose you all right," he said, sticking out his chin. "I'm going to. He's doing everything I said, brothers. And I'll tell you something else. He's trying to sew things up so that the members won't move unless he tells them to. Look at a few weeks ago when he was off in Philly. We tried to get a rally going, and what happens? Only about 200 people turned out. He's trying to train them so they won't listen to no one but him."
But, brother, didn't we decide that the appeal had been improperly phrased?"
a brother interrupted.
"Yeah, I know, but that wasn't it."
But the committee analyzed the appeal, and I know, brothers, and I don't aim to dispute the committee. But, brothers, it just seems that way because you don't know this man. He works in the dark. He's got some kind of plot.
What kind of plot? One of the brothers said, leaning across the table.
Just a plot, Restrum said. He aims to control the movement uptown. He wants to be a dictator.